All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome to Staff Council meeting number 235. I want to welcome first our new members. We have several new faces here. I'm thrilled to see you. I look forward to meeting you on break and after the meeting and so on. The challenge today for you is that our orientation for new membership is not until the February meeting. And we haven't set the schedule for that, so you will seem a little lost today. Please, I absolutely encourage you, raise your hand, speak up, ask for background information. I will go a little more in depth than I usually do because we have new membership. Hopefully you have before you an agenda. And obviously we follow the agenda with roll call, et cetera. Today we're going to go a little sideways with that and ask each of you to introduce yourselves just simply with your name and where you work. And then we'll get a little more in depth at the orientation. So we'll start here to the left with John.
John Glendenning, Environmental Health and Safety.
I'm Leslie Walls. I work for the Institute of Northern Engineering for the Alaska Center for Energy and Power.
Oh, okay. All right. I apologize. I should have pointed out that we have the speaker or the microphones because we are online and we let people call in and listen in online. So that's what the microphones are for. And I will regularly throughout our discussions pause and ask for comments from online. And if you are online at the end of this in the room, I'll ask if there's anyone online that wishes to introduce themselves. So go ahead again, Leslie. I'm sorry.
I'm Leslie Walls. I'm with the Institute of Northern Engineering, Alaska Center for Energy and Power.
All right.
Debbie Blevins, Cooperative Extension.
Okay.
Trish Winters, Power Plant.
Okay.
Debbie Coxon, Geophysical Institute.
Okay.
Erin Albertson, Geophysical Institute.
Robin Winett with the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Mary Alice Short with the College of Rural and Community Development.
Chris Bex, OIT Training and Development Group.
Jarkko Toivonen, OIT Network Operations.
Richard Rinchita, OIT.
Brad Crick, Rasmussen Library.
And Gary Newman, School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
All right.
Tom Langdon, OIT.
All right. And we'll go ahead and go online.
Hello, this is Adam Kane with the UAF Bristol Bay campus.
Please, can you repeat that again? We didn't have the volume up in the room.
Yes, this is Adam Kane with the UAF Bristol Bay campus.
And Kirsten Bay from Northwest Campus.
Devin Jepson from Interior Aleutian Campus.
Good morning, this is Kim with the College of Liberal Arts.
Hi, this is Tony Abbey, Project Manager in OIT.
All right, Jeanette?
Yes.
State your name and where you're working.
Jeanette Altman, Rasmussen Library,
thank
UAF
you.
Campus.
Thank you. And Gary Newman over there. Oh, you did speak. You did. We didn't. Anyone else online then, to be sure?
Nicole.
And Nicole.
Nicole Klopfer.
Hello.
Hi, Institute of Arctic Biology, currently advocacy chair. Terribly sorry I'm not present.
Hello, this is Selena. Can you guys hear me?
Just barely.
Okay, this is Selena Brown calling from the Bristol Bay campus.
Excellent. Excellent. We have outstanding attendance today from the rural campuses. Much appreciated. Anyone else online?
Debbie Gonzalez.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'm Claudia Koch and I work for the Vice Chancellor for Research.
I'm Joella Sparks. I work with the Cooperative Extension Service. If there anyone else, say, speak now or forever hold your peace. Great.
We have a quorum.
And we have a quorum. So now comes the fun part, and I apologize. I should have maybe blended these two pieces together, but we have roll call next. And have you hit record? Yes. And have you hit recording? All right. We are on. Now we will formally do roll call.
Joella Sparks.
Here.
Claudia Koch.
Yeah.
Pip Spezy. Adam Kane.
Here.
Kirsten Bay.
Here.
Evelyn Pinsgaard.
Here.
Selena Brown.
I'm here.
Sarah Batiste. Deb Jepson.
Here.
Mary Alice Short.
Here.
Debbie Gonzalez.
Here.
Leslie Walls.
Here.
Nicole Klepper.
Present.
So for the new reps, what she's doing now is calling by unit, role by unit. So I encourage you to pay attention to who is in your unit or who is grouped with you, because if you are not able to make a meeting, we ask that you seek out your alternate and ask them to come and vote on your behalf and take minutes and distribute out to your constituents on your behalf. So she is... I should have asked you to define that, but she is taking role based on your unit that you represent.
And I'm Nicole, if I haven't met you yet. Where were we?
All right, go ahead.
Debbie Coxon.
Here.
Jesse Atencio. Erin Albertson.
Here.
Gary Newman.
Here.
Ryan Keel. Ashley Monroe. Kim Eames.
I'm here.
Debbie Blevins.
Here.
Juan Gula. Robin Winant.
Here.
Trish Winters.
Here.
John Clendenin.
Here.
Jennifer Youngberg. Brad Crick.
Here.
Jeanette Altman.
Here.
Travis Brinzo. Richard Machida.
Here.
Yorko Toivonen.
Here.
Christian Bex.
Here.
Tom Langdon.
Here.
Cynthia Collins. Tony Abbey. Is there anyone
here? Here. Sorry, I was on mute.
No, it's okay. Is there anyone whose name was not called?
So, and thank you. So here is also where if you are an alternate and you know that you're here, in filling a representative's shoes or responsibilities for the meeting, this is where you go on the record and state your name and who it is that you're sitting in for. So we have it on record. So the next item then is approval of the staff council agenda for 235.
Move to approve.
Second.
Do we have any comments?
Oh, sorry.
We do have one change. We do not have minutes for meeting number 234 to approve today. Those will come with the February meeting.
This is Adam. I have one question. We received the draft agenda in our email a few days ago, but we haven't received a final agenda. Is that an issue?
What we're doing now is finalizing the agenda. So it is a draft agenda until we approve it today.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet. Any other changes to the agenda? I will note that Chancellor Rogers is traveling, and he will try to call in from an airport, so we'll be a little bit flexible in that particular item. All right, then, hearing no further changes, all those in favor of approving the agenda for 235 as amended, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? All right, hearing none, we have an agenda for today. Also, I will let you know, we are following Robert's Rules of Order, but I am pretty casual. I am a casual meeting leader. I have our, what would you call yourself, Gary? Gary keeps us in line. Yes. Yes, yes. He keeps me in line, keeps me on track with motions, et cetera, amended motions and such. So he's kind of our informal voice from the sky. So the next then we have, as we've tabled 1C to the February meeting, next we have public comment, which we are 2 minutes early for. We try with public comment to be right on the dot at 9 o'clock. I would ask, is there anyone in the room that wishes to make public comment? Hearing none, is there anyone online that wishes to make public comment? All right, then I will close the public comment period and move on to 3A, the officers' reports. With the break, with the Christmas break, it was, well, sort of quiet. I met with President Gamble on, January 3rd. His focus for that meeting was SDI, the Strategic Directions Initiative, the President's SDI. His focus with that was we've had the SDI meetings at the President's level, at the Board of Regents level. We've had conversations with the Chancellor and his leadership and his cabinet, and President Gamble says it's time now to get SDI down to the staff person's level and on their desk for staff to understand what SDI is and how it affects their work, and then how they can contribute to the success of SDI. So the Strategic Directions Initiative is it's another form of a strategic plan. You know, the President Gamble has launched into this initiative wholeheartedly with starting with listening sessions, and he held listening sessions at all the main campuses and rural campuses, and quite often, you know, everywhere that he could, and it included a handful of key people that were consistent through every listening session, and then Board of Regents were invited, and campus leadership was invited, community leadership was invited, and they were listening sessions on the university and all its aspects, students, staff, faculty, its role in the community, and so on. And from those listening sessions, five themes came out. And I don't have my list of themes, but essentially it's student achievement and attainment, partnerships with schools, partnerships with communities, and accountability is the fifth theme. The fourth is research, research in the communities, meaningful research. Now that's not the exact language, and I apologize, I don't have them memorized, but they are the focus of our president and his budget request to the legislature this year. Anytime you have a new initiative you want to seek funding for, you have to tie it to one of those five themes if you're going to have any success. So my conversation with the president was about taking those five themes and putting them on every one of your desks, and for you to see or think, and how can I contribute to the success of SDI? So the next steps, there's another meeting of leadership, the university leadership, campus leadership, prior to the Board of Regents meeting in February. And we'll examine where we are with SDI, finalize the five themes. We're also in the process of talking about metrics for measuring the success in those five themes. And that's the focus of the meeting, February 23rd, I believe it is, just prior to the Board of Regents. So yesterday I had a conversation with the Chancellor. Claudia and I meet every month prior to this meeting, one-on-one with the Chancellor, and we talked about ways to do just that, to get staff engaged with SDI, contributing to SDI and its success. And we come up with a couple of good ideas, and he's in the process of talking to his cabinet to initiate that. So, and I apologize to Claudia, I took one thing that she was supposed to talk to you about with that. That was the gist of my last meeting with President Gamble. That was the gist of a piece of our meeting with the Chancellor yesterday. Other things have certainly happened over break. I will talk about them more in depth because they are on the agenda. And with that, I will sign off unless you have any questions. Now, SDI, you've all got lots of emails in your spam from SDI. I would encourage you to investigate it. Staff Alliance at the statewide level is going to get very active in pushing this out there and getting feedback from staff. Our chancellor is going to be very active in seeking feedback from staff. So if you're going to be able to translate SDI for your constituents, I encourage you to go to their, they have a main page right off of alaska.edu. And I encourage you to go familiarize yourself with the five themes. The metrics are out there. They are very much draft. Don't get caught up in the metrics right now. They will change a great deal. Certainly, you are more than welcome to contribute to those metrics. If you see a particular performance measure that affects or what you do or how you do it, and you have some insight on that, I encourage you to send the feedback to me. I serve a dual role, and I should have explained this right off the bat. In staff governance, I serve a dual role. That is, I'm here today as president of UAF Staff Council, but I'm also chair of the Staff Alliance. Staff Alliance is 8 members, and it's the 2 officers from every campus staff council. So we have the Anchorage Staff Council and the UA Southeast Staff Council, and then we have the statewide, they call themselves Statewide Staff Assembly, but they're the same. So the 2 officers from those 4 groups make the Staff Alliance. We have direct access to the Board of Regents and to the President to talk about statewide issues. So in that role, I bring a lot more information to all of you to chew on, and I ask for a lot more feedback as a result. So I encourage you to go out and read up on SDI, and please don't hesitate to email me or call me with questions. And once I get to know you and I know where you work, for example, I know what you do, if something pops up, I might give you a call and say, hey, given your specific experience and expertise, what do you think on this particular point or this particular metric or such? With that, I promise I'll quit and I'll hand it over to Claudia.
Thanks. Now that you said everything that's on my list. No, but like she said, Staff Alliance met on January 15th, and we had Vice President Dana Thomas join us and Quinn Kooning, and they talked about the metrics, just like Joella just explained, and they want our input, and they're asking a wide variety of groups for feedback, what makes sense and what contributes to the SDI teams and SDI themes. And they're looking to get the metrics out by spring and get it vetted by the Board of Regents. Back then too, and he wants especially the staff input on every one, but he was just mentioning accountability on themes like diversity of faculty and staff and how the monitoring overall process of the university and the SDI themes goes. And then, like she said, we met with Chancellor Rogers yesterday. Unfortunately, he won't be here in February to host our annual breakfast, but he's looking into it if he can sponsor us at least a lunch for that day. So we gave him an estimate, and hopefully he can sponsor us lunch for the day. He also mentioned that he has a centennial project going on where he wants to write up sounds funny all of a sudden where he wants to write up all the memorial scholarships and the history of it. So when 100 years from now a student gets a scholarship, that he knows why he is getting that scholarship, and he's thinking about hiring journalist students to go ahead and do that. And he also wants our feedback on the new supervisor training. So if you have attended the new supervisor training and have any feedback you want to give back to the Chancellor, you can either email me or Joella, and we can pass it back to Chancellor Rogers. So, and that's all I had after Joella said everything. Thank you.
So let's see. The next item then, unless you have questions, is, of course, 9:15, item 4, remarks by the Chancellor. Chancellor Rogers, have you called in? So what I'll do for the next 20 minutes or so is listen for a beep, and I'll pause and ask if it's the Chancellor, and we'll get his remarks. The next item is our governance reports. So normally we regularly hear from the Faculty Senate President and the ASUAF Student President. And did we have something from Jennifer? No. Right, because we're coming off break, Faculty Senate hasn't met, so we don't have a report from Faculty Senate. ASUAF, I imagine that's the same. They've been on break, but normally at this time we'd hear from them. Before we launch into unfinished business, I want to kind of give you a little bit more information. Our February meeting will be a day-long meeting, and half of it will be a regular meeting, and half of it will be orientation. Go ahead.
What day of the week is that one on? Is that the Tuesday meeting?
19th, February 19th. I'm not sure the date. Day.
It's a Tuesday.
It's a Tuesday, yes.
Okay.
Okay. So let's see. We'll go into unfinished business. Claudia alluded to item 6A, the Carolyn Sampson Memorial Award. That I'll read here a little bit of history, and that I'll explain to you why it's on our agenda. The purpose of the scholarship is it's dedicated in memory of Carolyn Sampson, a former executive secretary in the UAF Governance Office. Carolyn was instrumental in obtaining support services for staff council and provided support for faculty senate and academic council while employed at UAF. The intent of the award is to provide new career paths or retraining to applicants wishing to reenter the job market and or whose work activity may be threatened by economic health or other factors. So essentially, when I first started several years ago on staff council, we were every spring we held a raffle, and we went around and we collected prizes, and then we raffled off tickets for those prizes as a part of the Staff Appreciation Day event. And the fundraising from that raffle went to building up the foundation account for this scholarship. So every year at February 15th is scholarship deadline, just as an FYI. And that's partly why I'm reading this or sharing this information with you now. So every year we give out, depending on, you know, the earnings off the foundation off of that fund, we give out scholarships to 1 to 3 people. And this past year, we gave out two $2,000 scholarships. I can't read that person's name, but Angelica Balem and Garrett Everidge were the two recipients this current academic year. The way that this scholarship is handled, so obviously we're not doing raffles anymore because we've built the fund up high enough that it's self-sustaining. And each year, you know, the fund, it depends how much we give out based on the earnings of that account. So what I'm presenting to this group for thought, and we don't need necessarily to take action today, is that the way the scholarship is handled right now, it's one of hundreds here at UAF, and essentially, it's a kind of an automated process. The students go into the listing of scholarships available, determine which ones they might qualify for, kind of check the box, write up their application for the scholarship, and then somehow, some way, they're awarded the scholarship. I haven't gotten into the details of it. My question to this group is, does that really honor this scholarship that we built, that we created and we built that amount to? So one thing I'm going to throw out there for you to chew on is we can work with the financial aid office, and we can put together every spring an ad hoc group, an ad hoc committee, temporary committee that meets once or twice, reviews the applicants for that scholarship, and we can decide who wins the scholarship if you're willing to be that engaged with the scholarship. We currently do that with the Chancellor's Cornerstone Award. We put the word out on that scholarship. We create an ad hoc that reviews the applicants and forwards names for the Chancellor's review. And with that, I'm going to pause. Chancellor Rogers?
Yes.
All right, then for those online and those in the room, as I indicated earlier, we are going to pause our agenda and hear from the Chancellor in an airport somewhere. Go ahead.
Good morning. Calling from a parking garage at the Anchorage Airport. Today is the Board of Regents retreat. Today and tomorrow, the Chancellors will be participating in the retreat today. We'll be looking primarily at how the Board addresses issues in the Academic and Student Affairs Committee today, looking at issues of program review, and then looking at issues of athletics. I want to welcome the new representatives to the Staff Council. It's nice to see the full membership fleshing out with this meeting, and would encourage each of the new representatives to take advantage of the leadership opportunities that the Staff Council provides. I really rely on the Staff Council as a way to get information through the organization. We find that multiple lines of communication really help reinforce messages, and look to you to bring to me issues that I need to be aware of, that you want the University of Alaska Fairbanks administration to address. Just a couple of items today. First, a quick budget update. Really no big news yet in Juneau. President Gamble briefed the House Finance Committee yesterday on the status of our budget request. The governor requested only the 50% of pay raise money, no new programs, and no other fixed costs other than a little bit in the way of leased cost and new facilities costs. That's really going to squeeze us in the FY14 budget. Because it's a low tuition increase, we're really trying to keep college affordable, and so the lowest tuition increase in a decade and the challenge of federal funds will put somewhat of a squeeze on us. We're trying to address the issues early. If there are affected units, to give early notice. Some of you are aware we did, there were a couple of layoffs in the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences in December. What we're, everyone at HR and at units are, I've really tried to reinforce the administration's position that first, we keep people on where possible. Second, if not, the earliest possible notice. And third, and most importantly, university policy provides for opportunity for rehire. And I've really tried to reinforce with HR, I don't consider that an opportunity. I consider it their mandate that we hold on to people. Even if the job changes, the experience at University of Alaska Fairbanks that people have is something we don't want to lose. And so while I would expect some adjustments next year, I really don't think the full impact of cuts will hit until FY15. A couple of other items. One, we have instituted a new supervisory training program. I'm interested in any feedback that people have on the supervisory training. Would encourage anyone who hasn't completed their safety training already to do so. We're really trying to push up compliance in both of those areas. Finally, the Strategic Directions Initiative. UAF is really focused on how can we play a significant role in carrying out the President's message. The five core themes of the Strategic Directions Initiative, how do we improve our academic success. Primarily, we're focused in the advising area, but there are other things we can do that help improve academic success. How do we build better partnerships with the schools? How do we build better partnerships with business and industry? How do we ensure that our research and development has a significant impact on the state? And how are we accountable to the people of Alaska? We're going to be announcing in the next week or so a new UAF sort of suggestions initiative for SDI. Essentially a suggestion box for ideas that staff and faculty have for things UAF can do that help advance strategic directions, with suggestions being evaluated really on three criteria. Does this help simplify and strengthen our services to students? Does it save money? And does it achieve the objectives of SDI? Still working out what how we will recognize, but looking at the top suggestion of the semester, we'll have a one semester gold parking pass next fall with gift certificates for the best in each of the five categories, and if the suggestion comes from a rural campus, it would be an equivalent award. I don't think a gold parking pass in Fairbanks does anybody in Nome a whole lot of good. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that members of the staff council might have.
Chancellor Rogers, I'm seeing none in the room. All right. All right. Well, thank you, Chancellor Rogers, for joining us. It doesn't appear that we have any follow-up questions. We appreciate the information and your efforts while you're traveling.
Okay. Well, thank you, and thanks to all for taking your time and effort to make the staff council successful.
Thank you, sir.
Bye now.
So let me explain one thing in there. I think it's important that there's not some confusion. One of the things that he mentioned was half funding of the staff compensation increases. So in the Regents budget that went to the governor, there was a 3.25% increase request for all staff next July 1. The way that that works is that the legislature typically only funds half of that increase, and the university has to come up with the other half. So what he was mentioning there, but I didn't want anyone to be confused and thinking, oh, we're not going to get the 3.25. What the president's trying to do is get the legislature to consider funding the full increase rather than the university having to come up with half of that 3.25%. So I just wanted to clarify that in case what I didn't want is someone to say, oh, we're not going to get the 3.25. That's in there. It's just a matter of how it's going to be funded. Did you have any other questions on the Chancellor's remarks? Okay, then we'll go back. Yes, Richard.
One question. I guess I missed that, but was the supervisor training mandatory or?
Supervisor training is mandatory for supervisors, yes.
And there's a penalty if you don't?
That's something that's really squishy, and that they haven't outlined. They've not outlined it in policy or regulation what it is. They contact regularly every supervisor, and essentially what I do know for the past program is that for the core courses, you were required to take those core courses. There were six of them in the first 6 months of your employment as a supervisor. Now, did that mean that they would, you know, withdraw or let you go, or I've not heard of a case of that. So I've not heard of there being repercussions, but it is written down that you're required to take the supervisor training as a supervisor. They have completely changed it. In the past, there were, I think, 12 different topics, six being core and then the others being elective. Now they just have three classes that you have to take, supervisor 1, 2, and 3. They're upping the numbers that those are offered. But essentially, those three pieces covered all of the topics that of the previous year. And you're supposed to, every 3 years, I think it is, as a supervisor, retake those classes.
Hey, thank you. I was just curious about the mandatory aspect.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I heard you say that.
Yes, it is. Excuse me. Those are considered mandatory for supervisors. Gary?
Since the question was asked, I wondered, have you been the courses, and are you finding a big difference between how they were and how they are now?
Oh, there's very much a difference. I have only taken the first one. I completed all of the previous program. I completed those, but the first one of the new program I took last week, 2 weeks ago, I was in it with Chancellor Rogers. I thought it was well done. It was a casual blending of the topics. There were a couple of things that I had concerns about how they framed them and how they might be misunderstood, and so I've given them feedback on that. But otherwise, I thought it was a good 3 hours well spent, good conversation. One suggestion I did make to the chancellor yesterday afternoon was that Brad and the instructors teaching those supervisor courses consider adding a half an hour on at the end. For direct questions, if a supervisor wants to ask a direct question on the content because they don't want to speak about their personnel matters, if they know that right at the end of the class, HR will still be there and they can talk with them. So that's one thing that I still have to make.
So they're an improvement in what was before?
I think it's a different way of doing it.
Okay.
Really, I myself, you know, having gone through a lot of, you know, associates, bachelors, and masters, I like a defined topic. We know what the topic is. This was a blend, but there was good conversation. So I wouldn't say it was an improvement, just a different way of presenting it. Any other questions?
Oh. Just a further comment on it. I think my understanding is that they're starting to roll the supervisor training into supervisor evaluations, along with safety training for all employees that's being rolled into the evaluation process, and it's being put into HR files whether you've done it or haven't done it. And I don't know where that's going to go, but that's kind of what I'm hearing.
Go ahead.
Is there a place where, like, I could go for our department and see what all training people still need to take, whether they've taken it or not? Is there a place anybody can go to see what is in Intellect?
Well, the safety training, yes, supervisor training, HR is monitoring that.
Right.
So will you contact HR to get the listing? Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions on the supervisor training? Okay, we'll then move back to the Carolyn Sampson Award Memorial Scholarship, actually. I'm going to bring this, again, for new members. We do have, as you noted, as you can see in the second part of the agenda, internal committees, University Advocacy, Elections, Membership and Rules, Rural Affairs and Staff Affairs. I will bring this question to Staff Affairs then on the Carolyn Sampson Memorial Award to see if they are interested in taking on being the ad hoc review of the applicants for that scholarship, or if we should leave it as is, unless, of course, someone cares to make a motion today. If not, what I will do is keep it on the February agenda, and then if there's no action taken on the February agenda, I'll let it go. Essentially. Are there any other what Claudia was talking about, you know, the Chancellor's has a very focused effort right now in building up the history and documenting the history of UAF as a part of the coming, 2017, our 100 year celebration. And as a part of that, for every memorial scholarship, he wants to put together a full history of every memorial scholarship so that, you know, the background is there. Well, oftentimes what happens, you know, you lose someone that's been here for 30 years and they take a lot of history with them. So he's in the process of putting all of that together, especially for the 100 years. So if there are no questions then on the Carolyn Sampson, I will move on to item 6B.
Joella, this
yes.
is Deb Jepson. Yesterday I went online to look for that application process just out of curiosity, and I found several of them, but I never found that one.
Okay.
Is there a different location than the number of ones they have listed out?
You know, I can't tell you how to locate it. I've never been through the scholarship process. So I couldn't tell you, but that's something we staff advocacy could certainly do is review it to see. One thing, you know, that we should consider at staff council is at least a campaign about the scholarship and making sure people are aware that we created it. And but I no, I can't, to answer your question, I can't. I don't know how to access it directly. I've not tried.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So, Joella, you mentioned two different committees for that now, staff council, or I mean advocacy and staff affairs. Which way should it go?
I think it should go to advocacy, actually, because it's, you know, the advocacy committee is about getting the word out about staff and what we do and I think that this is a way to do that. So I would say, but then for the record, thank you, John, for forcing the clarification. The Staff Advocacy Committee, that's Nicole Klopfer's committee. So back to 6B then, the healthcare benefit update. I'm sure and I hope all of you have been paying attention to the infamous 9 motions that came out of the Joint Healthcare Committee. And there's certainly documentation of those in our minutes, but also up on the statewide benefits webpage. So the result, these 9 motions came out of the Joint Healthcare Committee. Staff Alliance said, whoa, Staff Alliance put the word out and raised a ruckus, so to speak, and got the President's attention on those 9 motions. And as a result, he called for the Joint Healthcare Committee to hold forums at each of the 3 main campuses and also at statewide. So last week, there were 2 forums in here, and 1 forum up in Butrovich. Then the next day there was forums in Anchorage, And then today's the 23rd. Today there's a forum at the UA Southeast campus, all getting feedback on the nine motions of the Joint Healthcare Committee. I will say that the attendance here, there were probably 30 in the room in the first meeting and closer to 20 in the second meeting, several online, lots of people online, lots of questions. The focus of those questions first was, of course, the opt-out, taking away the opt-out motion. The second was the spousal surcharge, and the third was the WIN, the Wellness Initiative motion. I will say that, I through Staff Alliance, asked our members how the other forums went, and the Anchorage Forum was the same. They had about 50 in the room with lots more online, and they did not have enough time for their questions. And their questions were also in order with ours. The first the highest questioned motion was the opt-out, taking away the opt-out. So the update, that's essentially the update I wanted to give you. Next steps are that the Joint Healthcare Committee meets February 1, I think it was. They and will then have had the feedback from those forums. They'll make their next suggestions or recommendations on those nine motions to the Chief HR Officer and the President from there. So Staff Healthcare meets... Is it right before that and right after?
We're trying to determine a meeting. There's a doodle poll out.
Okay.
I would hope we would meet before JHCC.
Okay.
So that we could actually give information to JHCC rather than the other way around.
Right. So a little explanation here. Staff Alliance, which is the statewide staff group that I mentioned earlier, appointed a staff healthcare committee. And that staff healthcare committee gives input to the president on the healthcare benefit. The Joint Healthcare Committee is made up of three groups: union representatives, primarily. The greatest percentage of that committee is union reps. It's a 16-person committee. Then the administration, statewide, has membership on that committee, and then there are two staff representatives on that committee, two of 16. So. The Joint Healthcare Committee is put together as a result of the collective bargaining agreements between the unions and the university, and they are the formal advisory body to the Chief HR Officer and the President on the healthcare benefit. So every year they review the program, they review the vendors, and so on, and so they're the formal advisory body. Staff Healthcare is intended to give input to the president, but also to the two members of the Joint Healthcare Committee. So in any case, after that February 1 meeting from the Joint Healthcare Committee, we'll know more about the status of those nine motions. Any questions on that?
Is that February 1 meeting open? Or
no. Joint Healthcare Committee meetings are closed. A fact which ruffles my feathers a great deal.
When, after that February 1 meeting, will we know?
So we have two representatives on the Joint Healthcare Committee, they're both good at getting their notes out to me right away. I'll turn around, and I will use this as an opportunity to point you to the various blogs. As soon as I get the information from that meeting, I will post it on the Staff Alliance blog at uastaffalliance.wordpress.com, I believe it is. Yes. And I will post it right there. I will also post it on the UAF Staff Council info.blogspot.com. I will post it there as well. And then I'll ask Nicole to send all of you as representatives an email saying, hey, the information is on the blog, put it out to your constituents or point your constituents to it. So that's my goal, would be within days, you know, a day or two of having what happened at that meeting up on the blog. Any other questions?
Will the staff have an opportunity to comment on the results of those meetings after that point? Or is
yes, yes. Okay. So what will happen is you can bet that I meet again with President Gamble on February 12th or 13th. That will be on my list, is the results of that Joint Healthcare Committee meeting. I will go in and say, you know, Joint Healthcare is going to decide about the opt-out. I've already made staff's position on the opt-out really clear to the president and told him how many different ways this is wrong. My guess is it'll go away. But
what about the spousal surcharge?
That one's a little more iffy. There was a good deal of feedback on it at these forums here, and there were in Anchorage as well. That one's a little iffier. I would hesitate to put money down on that one. I do know at the December Board of Regents meeting, when the then Chief HR Officer presented those 9 motions to the Board of Regents, they questioned the fiscal sense of the opt-out, removing it, and they also questioned the fairness of the spousal surcharge. So while we have a new Chief HRO Officer, which is a good thing, we have a lot of pushback on this. I think they are also now, given the Board of Regents' interest in these 9 motions, they're paying attention to that as well.
Okay.
So,
you said the opt-out was the biggest issue. What was the order of the other two?
The spousal surcharge was second, and then the wellness initiative was third. I encourage you to pay attention to that wellness initiative. It's a tiered approach to biometrics being a part of how much you pay for your healthcare benefit. And Gary, is that an accurate description?
Yeah. I mean, it's still a little bit. We haven't seen the RFP yet. So.
Yes. Yeah. It's still a little fuzzy. My personal question, listening to their description of that at the forum, was, who's going to decide what healthy is? Who's going to decide the impact of your biometrics on your health, and therefore then how is that going to affect? So that's a question I think we need to keep in mind, is who's going to make these decisions, because certainly the experts disagree on what a healthy weight is and so on. And so I think that's something to pay attention. It is still very, very fuzzy. So there's a lot of opportunity for input on it.
So what I hear in there is, if your biometrics are less desirable, your rates will be higher. And
eventually, not quickly, not like next year, but it's a phased approach into.
They were looking at a three-year effort on this, and whether it's what your biometrics are, or rather, are you making improvement? That's still, I mean, we haven't seen any specifics.
Sounds like a whole lot of genetic selection to me.
So,
but.
Well, it was my understanding, and I attended that meeting as well, is that it isn't necessarily about your biometrics, but about improving your health.
Right.
And not
right.
necessarily about where you're at. But
then the question was raised, should I really be bad right now and trash my biometrics?
Yeah, exactly.
And like I say, if 95% of your biometrics are within range and one isn't,
right.
are you going to be heavily penalized
right.
for the one that is not?
Right, right. So I apologize to keep us kind of on track here. That is a very fuzzy thing. There's lots, as Gary has indicated, it's a three-year thing. There's nothing formal, but it's something I think you should all keep aware of. So unless there's – go ahead, Brad.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I did want to add this. I was at the afternoon meeting, and at least my sense from their responses, and like you said, we don't have details, is that it's not meant to be punitive. So, I mean, you could say, well, it is if some people are getting bonuses, but it sounded more like if you're part of the program, you could see a reduction. Not everyone who's not part of the program or isn't performing well will pay more.
Well, I think the program is not far from becoming mandatory.
They didn't say that at the meeting. I just think it's important to
yes.
point. You're
yes.
right. Maybe that is what it will be. But
yes.
that's not
yeah.
how they described it in the forum.
Right, right. So one of the things you'll find is that I'll give you facts, and I'll give you my concerns. And what you do with the facts, I hope, is turn around and accurately report them to your constituents. What you do with the concerns then is up to you. Please don't quote them as this is what's happening. And I hope, and if you have ever have any doubt of what I'm talking about, whether it's a fact or a concern, please don't hesitate to ask. One of the things that's critically important with these changes is that we get the accurate information out there. What I do with the blog posts, for example, is the information I either point directly to Statewide's benefit page, pull it directly from there, or I pull it directly from a presentation that has been made to the Joint Healthcare Committee or the Staff Healthcare Committee, or I will clarify a comment made by the benefits director or so on, because I want to be sure we have the right information up there. So I encourage you, when you're reporting out to your constituents, to go and refer to those pages as much as possible. Okay, so if there's nothing else, Robin?
I just wanted to say, I know for myself and that wellness initiative, I kind of, I think it was number 9 on the list. So by the time you've gotten done reading all 8 of them, you're like, okay, yeah, wellness initiative, blah, blah, blah. But I actually kind of think I misinterpreted it. I kind of read the word wellness and thought, oh, it's the wellness program. It's part of the WIN. Okay, that's good. And I think it's their language that they use that people didn't really take it seriously or as a big change.
Right. Well, so one thing that we're doing, Staff Alliance is doing, is putting together an FAQ component of the blog. And so when we hear lots of people asking the same question, it's clear that the Statewide's information that they're putting out is confusing or that there's mixed messages out there. So that's one of the things I encourage you to, if you're hearing a question, the same or similar question from a lot of people, send it to me. I will make sure it gets on that FAQ portion of the blog. I've also asked for better development of communications with the Statewide benefits people. Let us, have us look at it and make sure we can understand it, because we're the ones, putting the word out and answering the questions, not necessarily Statewide. So hopefully that'll improve the quality of all of that information. So we are running a little bit behind here, and so I'll keep moving on unless there's any other questions on 6B, the healthcare benefit update. Online, I apologize, I haven't specifically asked you. Did you have any questions? Hearing none, then I'll move to 6C, the employee tuition benefit update. Essentially, that is just an acknowledgement of an oops. As you, I hope, know, the tuition waiver benefit has changed effective January 1. President Gamble signed it and handed it to on December 6th or 7th and handed it to Staff Alliance the next week, and it was effective immediately. The problem was that it significantly changes the criteria for the waiver, and that information didn't make it to our business offices and so on in a clear and concise manner. So there is still confusion out there regarding it. In fact, actually, I assumed one thing when I went with my tuition waiver and was told another. I encourage you to question application of it for this semester. By the fall, all of the kinks will be sorted out with the various registrars and business offices. But this semester, if you have a staff person or you know of a student dependent complaining or questioning the tuition waiver for this semester, don't hesitate to send them either to myself I would recommend myself, actually, or Amanda Wall in the business office. She knows the interpretation. There is an amnesty period going on right now with this for this semester. So that's why I encourage you, if you hear someone complaining, oh my God, I'm going to have to pay all this tuition, say, wait a minute, are you sure?
Is that the 6-month waiting period?
That's the 6-month waiting period, the minimum GPA requirement, yes. Yes. So for the 6-month waiting period, if you were employed with the university prior to January 1, you do not have a 6-month waiting period. You're grandfathered in, yes. And if you came on January 3rd, then you have a 6-month waiting period before you can use that tuition benefit.
That's also for the GPA portion as well?
No, they weren't as definitive with that. That's where I would encourage asking to speak to Amanda. If you know, don't just go turn it in assuming you're going to have to pay. I would really ask them to ask questions, because I think there's an amnesty if your GPA is below a certain amount. For this semester, you won't have to pay, but you will next semester.
I know I've on a couple of different listservs for the registrar's office. I used to work there, and they don't know what to do with this tuition waiver and how to write the new tuition waiver paperwork up and all the roles, and they're so confused. They're like, does this mean when someone gives me this paper, I'm the one that needs to go in and look at their GPA and look at how long they were employed? Just because the supervisor they're all confused that the supervisor should be the one signing off on it, saying, yes, this person is eligible for this waiver. The business office people shouldn't be the ones having to go in and double-check all the different screens.
Actually, they're the ones that are cleared for it. My supervisor can't know what my GPA is. It's very confusing, and so a little bit of background. You know, Staff Alliance has been in discussions with the president on this benefit change for quite some time, and in fact, actually, I've asked him directly, where is this change for the last 5 months, and then it just showed up.
Yep.
And if we had known it was coming, Staff Alliance would have said, wait, whoa. It's better to do this at the start of an academic year, not in the middle of one. And you've already started registrations for the spring semester, and you're going to change the rules. So hopefully this is a lesson learned. I know the new chief HRO, the interim chief HRO, came out with some clarifications formally for staff, and I hope that you all received those. I put them up on the blog, and I'm assuming those also then went to the business offices, but... Gary?
Just real quick, I know we briefly talked about this. In the regulations, it says, if I'll see if I can quote this closely, if in the opinion of the supervisor the training or classes are of benefit to the university, then you can do up to three credits during working hours. There's a lot of latitude in that, and I don't know, has there ever been any definition of what benefit to the university?
No.
Okay.
No, not that I'm not. Before this change, this benefit hadn't been changed since 99 or 98, something like that. It had been in that format for quite some time.
Yeah.
So, and there was no definition of that in there. I think that, you know, it's a balancing act for the administration. What do you leave? Because you can't write a policy or a reg for every situation. You have to leave some flexibility in there, and my guess is that's where they chose to leave it.
Okay.
Brad?
To follow up on that, and I sort of hesitate to bring it up because I don't want to, you know, lead to a conversation that reduces anything for anyone, but I've certainly heard it said that there are supervisors who consider, hey, you're working on a degree, that's of benefit to the university, or, you know, versus, well, it's you're an accountant and this is an accounting class, so that's a direct benefit to the university. So, I mean, it seems like, yeah, the flex room is good, but it also makes me wonder, well, some people could be getting a much better benefit than others, you know, being able to take a class during work hours.
I would agree.
But I don't know how often that really happens, you know, hear about it.
That's one valid point, is how often does it actually happen. I will agree that, you know, I have had conversations with the president over this benefit where he acknowledges, you know, we're a university, and it's our responsibility to educate our employees and get the most out of them that we can. So that would then imply a degree is what counts. But, yes, ma'am.
Going back to the tuition waiver, is there a possibility that they could give a grace period for the add drop date? Because until this gets ironed out, it's a little scary to think Friday is the deadline to get stuff on or off, depending on whether it shakes out that you're going to pay or not pay.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. You know, another part of wiggle room that they gave is, you know, I believe, for example, Amanda Wall has the authority to waive some things and to, you know, you can appeal and they will waive it based on certain circumstances. I mean, that would be my guess. My understanding was that the amnesty period was January 25th. That basically, if your GPA, for example, didn't meet the minimums, and you registered and you paid or submitted the tuition waiver, you wouldn't have to pay tuition up to January 25th.
Part of why I bring it up is I had sent a message to our HR rep, the PPA for Facility Services, and they weren't aware of anything to do with this tuition waiver having been passed.
Yeah.
And so there's been people who've been hired that they may not have communicated this to who might be signed up right now, and we may not get the word out to everyone before the 25th.
Right. And so the challenge there is that I believe it was December 17th, somewhere in there, right as we're all headed out the door as sensible human beings in Fairbanks, Alaska. And they announced these changes. They announced the changes to the tuition waiver. So they consider that notice. If you're interested in working, well, if you're an employee here, here's your notice. We've changed this benefit. I think that's where the January 1 came in, was that, and which really distresses me, that an HR person who might be a part of a hiring process was unaware of this and didn't communicate this to a potential applicant or employee. With those special circumstances, the only thing I really can suggest is talking to Brad and talking to Amanda and saying, hey, we have the circumstances, can't we sign off on this, because, and they recognize that the president signing this and making it effective immediately and not communicating out that it was coming, they recognize that this has been a huge hardship and that there are going to be circumstances where you just have to not apply that rule.
Thank you.
Have one last quick question. Does anybody know on the tuition waiver the extent of taking a class as an audit or then having to withdraw from the class and that effect? That's the biggest question I've been getting from my constituents. A lot of people want to take a recreation class for audit because they don't want to have to go to every single class, but to most of them for good health.
How does a W affect your GPA?
Yeah.
Or
an audit.
We tried to get down in the details before he signed this, and this was back in...
This has been going on for 2 years.
Yes, it has. It has, and these discussions have been... I've been involved in almost every one of them, and it's been a constant challenge to get them to recognize the details, and we couldn't get them to do that, unfortunately. So, there were chunks of our issues list with the last draft that we saw that were not dealt with before he signed it. Mm-hmm. So the only thing I can say is to work with Amanda, because with the appeal process, there might be some flexibility. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to move on to item 6D, the grievance process review and mediation program update. The grievance process, where that is Staff Alliance. I asked Staff Alliance, when we're talking about building flexibility into policy and reg, because you can't write a regulation for every circumstance, my feeling is that the grievance policy and reg is very ambiguous and it's to the harm of the staff that it doesn't it's very challenging for someone filing a grievance to know what the policy and reg is and the procedure. And so that's what I've asked Staff Alliance to do, is to look at that policy and reg. And it came out of the President Gamble's request for review of Board of Regents policies and regs last year. So I said, great, if we're reviewing policy and regs, I don't like that grievance policy. Let's have a look at it. So I have an ad hoc group with Staff Alliance talking with the lead in the statewide HR on this. They've put together a flowchart for the process, and now we're identifying flaws in the process. So my hope is that we have a more clearly defined process that's a little fairer to staff, clearer, and then also tools that help you navigate the process. So that's an update on that. That's where we are with it. The mediation program, we should probably remove that. That's an item that there's been no action on. 6E, the reorganization working group, just really quickly on that one, there has been a sense primarily by staff council leadership that this existing form as a governing body isn't working. There's been some challenges with it. So a group of staff council representatives, past and present, got together, and they're putting together reorganization proposals for a way to reorganize staff council. There'll be a full presentation of that proposal at the February meeting, and maybe even a part of the orientation. But I'm just explaining to you a little bit of that background. This has been about 6 months or so in the works. And any questions on anything? Richard?
Would that presentation be during the orientation or during the regular meeting?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure that we've decided that. I mean, I think it should be a part of the meeting. If we're going to take an action, we'll make it a part of the meeting, but we might give a little history as a part of orientation to better equip the new representatives to make decision on that proposal. So let's see. Right now, our next item then is a five-minute break. Are we 9:55? We're actually right on time for a break until 10 o'clock. Let me talk to the guest speakers back there, but I'm going to go ahead and release us for a five-minute break, and we'll see you at 10 o'clock. Okay. I will call us back to order then. We are at 7A, Staff Council Orientation and February Face-to-Face Meeting. So what I have is, as I indicated, at February 19th, all day. We have a couple of housekeeping notes here for 7A. At this point, we have two representatives traveling from rural campuses. If you are not one of those two that have communicated with Nicole, please do so this week if your intent is to travel in for the February orientation. Both orientation and the meeting are in IARC 501, not here in Wood Center. I haven't put together the agenda yet for orientation. I, of course, will work with the admin committee for the agenda for the regular meeting, but I'll meet with Nicole this week or next to put together the orientation agenda. Is there any input you all would like to provide on the orientation?
Will just new members be required to go to orientation?
Everyone is welcome. But new members, yes, are the only
are
required.
Are you expecting it to be like an 8:30 to 4:30 day? 8:30 to 4:30 day?
Okay. So we have the room from 8 to 4. And rural reps, if they're traveling, we will definitely be done at 4, if not a little earlier. Any other questions on orientation? Any input you want? Any suggestions you might have for that?
This must be an old question. Have we considered doing it in January?
I'm sorry, I can't give the history on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just for the, you come to the January meeting having no idea, but
right.
Then orientation isn't for another month.
Right. I remember why February, and I think it's because, of course, this meeting is so close to classes starting and all of that, and there was concern whether or not the rural campuses would be able to come in because they have different start dates.
That makes sense.
Right. Okay, if there are not any other questions or comments on 7A, 7B, we'll move to the Chancellor's Cornerstone Award. We have an ad hoc that needs to come together and review those nominations for the Chancellor's Cornerstone Award. This is the meeting where I call for membership in the ad hoc if there is someone that would like to take the lead on the ad hoc. And generally, they've met just once, correct? Am I correct? Yeah, they met just once, reviewed the nominations, and forwarded the top three, am I correct? Top four, in order to the Chancellor for his review and decision. This is an award that he gives on Staff Appreciation Day. And the ad hoc the nominations are open right now, and they close February 20. And so the ad hoc would probably meet that week following February 20. Do we have anyone interested in taking the lead on the forming an ad hoc? Yes, Brad. Oh, you wish?
I'll volunteer.
Okay. And did I see Mary Alice?
Yeah. Okay. I'd like to be on the committee, too. I just don't want to take the lead of the committee.
Okay.
And I know last year, Brad, we came in and everything got brought up. We weren't able to meet until, like, March.
Okay. So we have three members then for the ad hoc committee for the Chancellor's Cornerstone Award.
I will say it's a really rewarding committee to serve on and to read all of the nominations about what comes in. It is kind of a fun committee. We just met for like 3 hours one morning.
Okay. So we have then for membership for the Chancellor's Cornerstone Ad Hoc Committee, Brad Crick, Mary Alice Short, Robin Winant.
And I'd like to do it Deb Jepson.
Deb Jepson and Claudia Koch. Thank you very much. That was so easy. Next is 7C then, Staff Make Students Count Award. This is a statewide award, comes out of Staff Alliance, but we put together, but there is an award for each campus or each MAU. Similar thing, ad hoc committee will open. Staff Alliance is in the process right now of reorganizing the whole process, but in the next month we'll get the announcement that the nomination period is open. There is a set of criteria. There will be an end date, and the way that it works is that an ad hoc committee from here reviews those, makes a recommendation for the one. They select the one award for UAF, and it goes to Staff Alliance. The winner of that award is receives a cash award, and airline tickets is recognized at a Board of Regents meeting and meets with the president as well.
Uh-oh.
So is there anyone interested in taking the lead on the ad hoc committee for the Staff Make Students Count Award? Okay, Richard. All right. Thank you. And then what I will ask anyone here and online is if you want to investigate it a little bit. Again, it's a meeting once or twice. You review the nominations for the Staff Make Students Counts Award, and then you make the decision as to the recipient, and it's forwarded to Staff Alliance. I encourage you to contact myself or to contact Richard Machida if you're interested in serving on this ad hoc committee. Any questions then on any of that? Hearing none, we are going to move to item 8, the guest speakers. And first up, we have Derek Miller and Julie Larwith. 8A.
Good morning. Oh, is it on?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're here this morning to introduce ourselves. Both Derek and I are here as part of the Office of Management and Budget with UAF Financial Services, which is an office that was created within the last year. And so we wanted to attend this meeting today to give you a little bit of information about the FY14 budget requests that are currently in motion as part of the legislative session down in Juneau now. Give you a little budget pocket handout. It's a little guide that we made that will hopefully give you a little bit of information about the requests and let you know who we are and what our role is, as well as handing out a few things about the fiscal climate. A presentation that the Chancellor made to the Chamber of Commerce yesterday about the state of the university with some overarching UAF challenges and opportunities, and so we thought we would come and share that with you today as well. So basically, UAF OMB was created within the last year as part of administrative services, financial services, because UAF wanted to focus a bit more on budgets and plans, start looking forward a bit more in the fiscal arena rather than just being really good at knowing what our expenditures are. And so essentially our positions were carved out of existing positions within financial services And Derek and I are the two members of that office now. It's possible that we'll have a third later if as positions are refilled. But essentially, we focus, Derek is a senior budget analyst, and I'm the director, and essentially we are spending a lot of our time looking at data, validating data, writing reports, helping units with budget analyses and plans. We work a lot with the UAF leadership and with deans and directors, staff and faculty to assist with FY14 budget requests, getting those in good shape to move up to statewide and then eventually on to the state of Alaska, things of that nature. So that's basically our role. A lot of reporting. I know we will assist units with their data validation and reporting where we're able to. Just the other day, the Office of the Vice Chancellor for Research wrote up a report with a lot of data on how many proposals UAF has per year and what's the success rate and things of that nature. And we got a copy of it, and we're going to be providing some feedback so that we can double check that the data is good data. Everybody's on the same page, so as we publish reports, UAF has a consistent message about some of its key priority areas, so things of that nature. We're going to be assisting the Provost Office this year with the UAF Planning and Budget Committee, which I am actually very excited about. That committee has existed for, a number of years, and that committee essentially brings requests forward from each of the units, and they discuss it, and they rank them based on accreditation core themes, UAF areas of priority. And so OMB will be the staff that is working with the Office of the Provost to take feedback and input from Cabinet to provide that committee information on what are the fixed costs that UAF already has that this committee needs to know about, what are the things already in the hopper that are on the list, and then that committee will bring forward new items that UAF may want to invest in the future. And so that will be kicking off sometime in February, so we're coming up on that beginning process, and that group will be putting together the request items for the FY15 budget process. So even though it sounds kind of far away, we're already going to be working on those things. Additionally, our office is sort of the central point of contact when things of a budget nature need to get forwarded up to statewide or the board. That's fiscal information or request narratives or things of that nature. Our office is usually the liaison to Michelle Rizik's office, I think she's wearing two hats these days, but I think she's statewide budget and planning as well as human resources at the system level. But we do interact with her office almost daily to make sure that UAF is giving, you know, anything that they're asking for up at statewide, we're providing it to them so that they can respond, especially while those folks are down in Juneau right now advocating for our requests. One of the other things that we have as part of our role within OMB are process improvement initiatives. And this is actually a lot of fun. For me, as a process improvement facilitator, some of you may have heard about this effort over the years. The chancellor, several years ago, I think back in 2010, had an executive leadership workshop where one of the outcomes of that was that UAF should start looking at their administrative business processes, things like how fast it takes to hire somebody at the university, some of you are laughing, yes, because it takes a long time. Travel processes, for example, and how cumbersome or complicated they are. Procurement on restricted funds or those type of procurements that involve chemicals or hazardous materials, for example. But there is now a group of facilitators that are under the umbrella of OMB. We work with them to form teams to then try to map out what these processes look like today, create them in an ideal world, and then build a project plan to try to chip away at those things and actually make headway on improving some of the processes out there that we know to be complex. So some of the first ones that we're looking at now are recruitment. and this team, as well as grant award management. I think they're calling it award setup and management. And so essentially process improvement is another arm of OMB, and we hope to be working with each of you out in your units as these processes touch you to gather feedback and to try to make improvements and chip away at these things so that it's a little bit better for all of us. So with that, I will turn over the mic to Derek, who will walk us through some of our handouts.
Good morning. Is this can everybody hear me fine?
No.
You're off. There you go.
Is that better?
That's a process improvement right there.
So I'll just real briefly run through the handouts, beginning with this 8.5 by 11 sheet here, the top sheet. And again, as Julie mentioned, my name is Derek Miller, Senior Business Analyst with Office of Management and Budget. And this top sheet here is an excerpt from the Chancellor's State of the University presentation yesterday at the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. And it's also some of the things that he talked about is high on the minds of Julie's and mine at OMB. So real briefly here, this first bullet here, state and federal budgets. I'm sure everybody in this room is very well aware. 90% of the state's revenue comes from our natural resource oil wealth, and that's a function of oil throughput through the pipeline and the price of oil. And as throughput continues to decline and the volatility in oil price exists, that uncertainty has caused a very conservative budget that the governor has introduced this year and in recent years past, and the legislature is expected to probably be conservative as well. Federal budget, everybody's probably read the paper and the effects of sequestration and the uncertainty there, and budget deficits, those two combined factors make both those revenue resources uncertain at this point, so that's a challenge. Low tuition increase. Beginning next year, we're going to have a 2% increase in tuition rate. We've seen between 5 and 10% in the last decade, so this is going to be something new. I think is an effort by administration. When a part-time student in particular has the choice to pay their heat bill or take a discretionary college course, they're going to pay their heat bill first. So this is kind of an effort to try to capture some of those students and make college more affordable for full-time students as well. Aging heat and power plant is also a significant challenge. It's nearing the end of its 50-year useful life, and there's equipment failure risk, there's financial risk, there's safety risks to the existing plant. The Interior delegation did tour the facility before they went down to Juneau here earlier this month, so they're very well aware of the problem. I think most of them know that there's a $22 million FY14 planning and design request in the current budget. That's to get us to the next phase to try to get us a new power plant, a heat and power plant, I should say. And then ultimately the entire facility will cost anywhere in the ballpark of $225 to $250 million to construct a new heat and power plant for UAF. Deferred maintenance, the governor did include in his budget $37.5 million to address some of the backlog in deferred maintenance leads that the university has. This is year four of a five-year commitment that he has had to address deferred maintenance, and the $37.5 million figure comes from the university's share of public facilities in the state of Alaska. The university owns about 37.5% of public facilities in Alaska, so that's where that figure comes from. In the budget that's not funded is an additional $75 million that the Board of Regents requested. We're hopeful, optimistic, not optimistic, but we're hopeful that we can get a portion of that $75 million in the budget. Partially funded facilities is a reference to the two engineering facilities, both at UAA and UAF. We're only half funded, and that roughly $50 to $60 million that we have already secured in last year's budget is enough to complete the outer shell of the engineering building. We need the other half of that funding to complete the facility, and we're going to break ground on that engineering facility on March 1st. So there's a lot of work ahead for us in the next 80 days until session adjourns to make sure that our legislators know about that commitment and to get the rest of that funding for the engineering facilities. Higher education models is a reference to the massive online open courses that we've seen and the competition that we've seen from University of Phoenix and other institutions. It's just a note to ourselves that this is an area that we have to address to remain competitive. And as some of you might be aware, in 2012, the Chancellor did reorganize our distance education structure, and it has transformed into e-learning and distance ed, so we hope to see the fruit of our labor here soon in that regard. The next slide is UAF opportunities, and obviously research is always an opportunity for us. There's a lot of niche markets that we have out there, including unmanned aerial vehicles, the Kuliak ship, which just got launched late last year, and we hope to see it. It's going to be in Alaska in January 2014, ready for some of our research endeavors. Biomedical area is a very is a high interest that we have and a niche market that we have. Instruction opportunities there, revitalizing our core curriculum, an emphasis on advising. You'll see that in our FY14 budget request, and then expanding online opportunities. Also, the Chancellor did mention in his presentation yesterday the vet med program, the 2+2 program that we have with Colorado State. We can now enroll 10 to 12 students a year in the vet med program, and it's an area of need that we're continually trying to address. Other areas of need include emergency management program with the School of Management. There's an FY14 request that emphasized accounting and accounting controllership. And he did mention in engineering there's potential opportunity to expand our engineering program to offer a chemical engineering program as well. Service is a reference to our service delivery and process improvement that Julie had mentioned previously. And this could take shape in instruction, student support, financial support, human resource support, facilities transformation, the fourth bullet. The Chancellor just wanted to make sure and mention, if you didn't know, and this is to an external group that he was speaking to yesterday, that some may or may not have been on campus recently, but a reference to the electrical distribution upgrade, the wastewater treatment facilities, the deferred maintenance on our buildings, the Margaret Murray, which I'll have to get used to saying, life sciences facility, and then the P3 dining and housing, which I think a lot of folks are impressed with that effort, that public-private partnership that we're pursuing to revitalize the Wood Center and to also build some new housing units on campus. Our online strengths, distance ed, we have to continually look at our distance education. We did that with the reorganization last year and work on offering more all online programs at the university. And then he also put a plug in for our brand, our naturally inspiring brand, that a significant amount of time and effort went into last year and is important to our stakeholders, both internal and external. So that's a brief synopsis. Probably didn't do the Chancellor's presentation justice, but those are the highlights of his presentation and what he's saying to external groups like the Chamber. And then the following pages on this handout is also an excerpt from a larger report that our office, Julie and I, put together and that we're going to put online here real soon. And it goes into greater detail on some of the challenges and some of the opportunities that we have as a university, with an emphasis on budget and an emphasis on financial matters. Did you want to go through
that? So I know we're pretty much out of time here, but we did want to encourage you to take a look at the handy pocket guide. Marketing was fantastic to work with and helped us brand it. But essentially, it's just a snapshot of our FY12 revenues. So it gives people a kind of a quick and dirty way to just get a general sense of the budget, as well as if something changes that's like a major factor that impacts UAF, like tuition or student credit hours or utilities cost or compensation, if that changes by 1%, that's how much it actually impacts the UAF budget. So each percent matters. And so these are how, we look at things when we make projections. Is our student credit hours going to be up 3% or down 3%? And when it's down 3%, it equals this much money. And this is how it translates into program growth or other areas that we can make investments in. So if you have questions, feel free to find us. We're online, www.uaf.edu/omb. And our contact information is in some of the handouts that we gave you today, and we appreciate your time.
May I ask just one quick question?
Please.
In Chancellor's presentation yesterday in regards to the research, was energy research and development one of the topics that he broached, other than just the research ship and the biomedical?
Yeah, there are a number of research initiatives that he rattled off, and he's got a couple slides in his presentation that lays out all these research initiatives, and I believe the energy was one of them.
Is this presentation available for others to view?
I think we just got a copy yesterday from the Chancellor's office, and we'll be posting it with the FY14 material that we've given you here, so that will be available. I don't know if Morgan's got it up on the Chancellor's site, but they may, or through marketing. But we'll put it up on the OMB page if you'd like to check it out.
Gary?
Yeah, just a couple questions. Thank you guys for coming. It sounds like you got your hands in a lot of things and trying to figure out what is really going on. I noticed in the Derek referred to the heat and power plant being somewhere between $225 and $250 million. That's grown quite a bit from when it was originally envisioned of $135. In fact, on the text here, I think it refers to $175.
Mm-hmm.
This being a proposed primarily coal-fired power plant with some EPA efforts to try to eliminate coal-fired power plants, it seems logical, and I realize you guys aren't in policy, but when you're looking at some of the economic paybacks of maybe toward getting more in line with what the legislature is trying to do as far as getting natural gas here, and your cost for a power plant for that is about half. So it seems like there may be some way of incrementing some savings there if we can have our folks saying to the legislature, hey, you know, $100 million may seem like nothing compared to Susitna, but for us it's a big dollar and
sure.
Should solve a lot of the air quality issues as well.
Sure, those are good comments, and I know there's a team working on that, and there's some trade-offs with whether you go with natural gas versus coal. You know, the capital costs are significantly lower, as you mentioned, but the operating costs are a little bit higher than if you go with coal, but probably need Bob Shefchik or somebody else coming in here to really speak.
Yeah, of course, that's a very sticky and political issue,
yeah.
But it is important to note that cost goes up because we have to wait year after year because we're unable to tackle these deferred maintenance needs. And essentially, had we done some power plant renovations 10 years ago, we may have been closer to those original ballpark figures. And so unfortunately, as the politicos battle it out and try to bring natural gas to Fairbanks, where Anchorage won't have the same issues because they have the ability to use natural gas, the longer we wait, it adds to the complexity of the problem and the cost.
It's also added to the cost of a gas line having
absolutely, right. So these are not easy issues to tackle.
Any other questions?
Can those documents be scanned and sent to people who are on the phone?
We can scan them and send them to
Nicole.
Who? Nicole? Okay.
What we'll do for those online is we'll ask Julie to send these documents to Nicole, and she'll send them out as attachments to today's information.
Thanks.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions online? All right. Thank you both.
Thanks for letting us be here.
You bet. So as I understand it, our next guest, Ann Ringstead, was to call in. I'm asking now, Ann, are you online? All right. Then not hearing a response, not seeing her in the room, we'll move to committee reports. So as some background, we have constitutionally four standing committees. As I read them earlier, University Advocacy Committee, Elections Membership and Rules Committee, Rural Affairs Committee, and Staff Affairs Committee. As newly elected representatives, some of you should know that you are required to participate in a committee. We have committee, the internal committees, we have the external committees, and we external statewide committees, and then the external UAF committees. So if you look at items 9, 10, and 11, you'll see quite a selection there of committees. The internal committees, if you look in our Constitution, each of those has a mission. They have a purpose. And their agenda certainly changes from month to month to year to year. And then the external statewide committees, those change, although 10A, the Staff Alliance Staff Healthcare Committee, it's a standing, it will stay. It will always be there. The Compensation Committee, the Staff Alliance's Compensation Committee, has been active the last couple of years. Its mission changes. I've significantly changed half of its mission this year. And then the External UAF Committee. So if you look at that list, 11A, B, C, on down to K, I think, you have things like the Master Planning Committee and the Parking Advisory Committee, the Diversity Action Committee, the Planning and Budget Committee that Julie was referring to, and others. All of those are, you know, standing UAF committees that the chancellor or their chairs have asked for staff representation on, and so they come to staff council for that representation. We do have two committees, 11B and H, that are in need of a staff representative. So I'll have you look at those when we get to 11, and I will ask for volunteers. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice. So I want to clarify a couple of things. From Julie and Derek's information, the budget process and the way that it works is essentially, you know, they've already, each campus and each MAU, major administrative unit, almost got sucked into that, major administrative unit, are required to create their own budgets. So UAF pulls a budget together from the different schools, from the different groups on campus, pulls a budget, their budget together. Those budgets, the chancellors deliver those budgets to the president. President and his Office of Management and Budget pull together a compiled University of Alaska budget. It's a big one. Encompasses all of the funding for the university and all of its corners. That budget then goes to the Board of Regents. The Board of Regents review the president's request. They ask questions, they ask justifications, and so on, and the changes are made until usually in November, the Board of Regents approve a University of Alaska budget request. That budget request goes to the governor. The governor then looks at that budget, and he says, well, this is my budget for the University of Alaska. And so you'll see documentation where here's the Board of Regents budget request, here's the governor's budget request, and then the legislature steps in. And the legislature looks at the governor's, and they look at ours, and the legislature comes up with their budget for the university. And as we all know, in the last 35 minutes before the end of the session, they decide what our budget's going to be. What's going on here with Julie and with Derek, and you, we should have heard from Ann today, and at the statewide level, we have their counterparts at the statewide level come to Staff Alliance and do the same thing. Essentially, what they're saying is be aware of the budget. Be aware of what's happening, and if they're looking at, you know, one thing I will tell you, the difference between the Board of Regents budget and the governor's budget, the governor took out all new program funding. He took all of it out, and he cut some other things too. But it's significantly lower than ours. So then the Board of Regents request, I should clarify that. So what they're saying is be aware of these things, because there are lots of opportunities, and that's probably what Ann was going to talk to you about today. There are lots of opportunities for you to provide input directly to the legislature. The LIO office here and Ann Ringstad and Chris Christensen, who is the University of Alaska's liaison to the legislature, they'll put out, and there is a listserv you can get on if you want to hear about it. They will put out announcements that the university, House or the Senate committees on the university's budget are meeting, and they want your input. And then you can go to the LIO office, Legislative Information Office, and testify before those committees, and they'll give you all the specific dates and information you need. So I encourage you to kind of keep aware and keep listening. I will put out calls as the legislature progresses and we see what's going to happen to the budget. I will go and I will testify on behalf as chair of Staff Alliance representing about 2,700 university employees and say to the legislature what you're doing here, the decision you're, you know, here's the impacts of it. So that's where they're coming from. They want you to be aware of the gist of our budget request. They would love you to go and talk to your local legislators and tell them how this budget request affects you as a voter. I think that's part of what's going on here, keeping us aware so that we can then turn around and be effective advocates for our university with the legislature. So I wanted to give you the process for the budget and how and where we are now. We know what the governor's request is. We know what our regent's request is. We're a long ways from knowing what the legislature has in mind for us. The Chancellor's Planning and Budget Committee is one piece of the process. Nicole Klopfer is continuing as our representative on that committee, but it sounds like they're changing the role of that committee in years past. So with every budget, there's a piece that's basically, there's a long story behind this, but essentially it's giving input to the Chancellor for not for next July 1, but for July 1, 2014, that budget request. That's what they'll be doing with this committee in the spring. So that just a little bit more background information. I will swing back, unless there are any questions, I'll swing back to 9A. Nicole Klopfer is the chair of the University Advocacy Committee and indicates through the agenda that they've not met. Obviously, as I told you, with a break, a lot of the committee work quiets. They haven't met yet. As new representatives, I encourage you to review the mission of each of these committees and determine which one you wish to participate in and contribute to. At the February meeting, the chairs of these four committees will make a brief presentation to you about their mission and ask you to join their committee. Nicole, did you have anything you want to say now, or do you want to save it for the February meeting? I'm assuming you're still online.
Wow, you were just saying everything for me, so I thought I'd wait. On the 30th, advocacy will be meeting. A preliminary agenda so far is discussing council onboarding and start brainstorming for that. Probably after the February meeting, we'll get a better feel about what we really need to touch on, what our strengths and weaknesses are in regards to orientation and getting new members familiar with council processes. Also, we're going to talk about fundraising for the Staff Council Travel Support Fund. I have a call into Emily Dragas, and I have to call her back today, about the fundraising coordination policy and what exactly it will entail in order to do a raffle-type fundraiser. The stipulations of doing that is different if you're an external student body and you're raising money versus if you're staff and you're raising money for staff. So as soon as I get that all figured out, we'll be able to make more progress with that and possibly be able to do something for Staff Appreciation Day.
All right. Any questions for Nicole? All right. Then thank you, Nicole. And we'll move on to Richard with Election Memberships and Rule.
Well, I just met with Walker literally practically on my way out of town about a week ago, so I have not scheduled a meeting. I have
okay.
not.
Right, I'm sorry.
Sort of
yeah.
Trying to catch up on what was going on.
I should have introduced Richard as the brand new chair of EMR, and we're thrilled that he's stepped up. Walker, lurking in the back of the room there, has been the chair of EMR for quite some time. He is our sage. Past chair, we miss him very much, and we expect him to, you know, do a data dump for Richard.
I think he volunteered to do everything.
Oh, he did. Oh, awesome. So I'm sorry, Richard, I put you on the spot there, not explaining that you're brand new. If there's nothing else, I'll move to Rural Affairs and Jeanette.
The Rural Affairs Committee did meet on January 8th. The meeting report is attached, but for the benefit of those who may not have the agenda, I'll just go over really quickly some of the things we talked about. First of all, we really wanted to thank Brad Crick for his service over the last 2 years. He was the outgoing chair. I was just elected in the last meeting, so thank you, Brad. I did make the mentioned a visit to the CRCD directors meeting, and they were very, very supportive. I also heard some great things from them about our new representatives, Adam, Kane, and Kirsten Bay. So we're really happy to have you on staff council. Let's see. We did discuss the travel budget, so our new rural representatives can come to the February meeting. I hope. I haven't heard whether or not they're going to be taking advantage of that. And we started talking about some of the things that we could work on this year, and one of the things was identifying and addressing the concerns of rural staff. And with that in mind, I wanted to definitely extend an invitation to Adam and Kirsten for our meeting. Our next meeting is Tuesday, February 10th. They're almost always teleconferences, so if there's any questions, I'm available, and feel free to contact me via email.
All right. Thank
oh,
you.
Sorry. One thing that I didn't talk about is that we also talked about in that meeting starting a proposal for travel to rural campuses. That was another thing that the directors of CRCD were very in support of. It is widely accepted that that is the best way to get our message across is a face-to-face, and the directors also encourage that. So we are going to start, as a committee, starting to write a proposal and ask the chancellor for funding to send one of our representatives out to each campus.
Great. Thank you, Jeanette. Any questions? All right, hearing none, we'll move to staff affairs. Mary Alice.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Staff affairs has not met. We are very, very small right now, so over the holidays, everybody seemed to be gone or on vacation. I think the last conversation Joella and I had is we were going to sit down and try to come up with an agenda for the February meeting and looking at changing the dates because it seems to fall after the staff council meeting every time, so we need to get it moved ahead of the staff council meetings so that we can get more information out. So any of you new people want to join a committee, staff affairs needs some people.
All right, thank you. Again, a reminder, please look over our constitution and bylaws and the mission and the responsibilities that you all signed up for, knowingly or not. all right, we'll move on to item 10, the external statewide committee reports. Gary or Debbie, was there an attachment?
There was. It's a little out of sequence, but
okay.
It should be near the end.
Okay. All right. Are there any highlights either of you wish to?
Well, I mean, it's pretty obvious that there are some real serious disagreements with going forth with both the spousal surcharge and the opt-out, eliminating the opt-out. And just running the numbers that they gave us, they says, oh, well, we would recover, say, $800,000 for 25% of the employees that they examined, multiply that times four roughly for the total number. We recover $800,000 in premiums, and it would only cost us $400,000 in paying for health care services. When you ask a little further, that $400,000 was only 18% the employees' part of that recovery or cost actually to the plan. So multiply that in turn as roughly 20%. So suddenly it looks like it's a $2 million hit to be able to force people back onto the plan. To the university. And when I asked about that, the answer was, oh, well, we'll ask the legislature for more money, and we know where that'll go. So the question I have, I guess, of this group and maybe of Joella is, do we need to do a resolution just to say, you know, this is stupid, guys? The people who you're trying to benefit don't want it, and it doesn't it negatively impacts the university, and just call that good?
Yeah, that's certainly within the authority of this group. I will say that a part of processes is, for example, if staff affairs wanted to take up this issue and specifically respond to each of the 9 motions, they would bring that motion here, and we would vote on it. But any one of you at any time can certainly make a motion bring a resolution forward for action by this body.
Yeah, either that or give us direction as to what you'd like us to do on staff health care committee to in turn feed something to joint health care committee.
So, for example, right now, Leslie could say, I would call for a vote. How many
call for a vote. I have also strongly encouraged, recommended, no, I wouldn't say strong-armed, the folks within my group to read the presentation and make any and all comments, concerns to Erica Van Fleen about these changes, because we have so little voice within the Joint Health Care Committee for these changes. So I definitely would like to put forth that motion that any disagreements we have as far as the opt-out and the spousal surcharge be put forth.
So one thing I would say, because we have so many new members today, we have people that might not know the issue. And so we can do this in any number of ways. We can say, let's take a vote on whether or not we're comfortable voting, or we can go right into someone,
I mean, we could do just a sense of the body, where it's not a formal vote, it's more an advisory vote to tell us on staff health care committee what to go forth.
Right. That's
so
another.
I guess my question is anybody really unclear about what's being proposed? So everybody is clear. Everybody raise your hand. Okay, everybody's clear. So how many people would be in favor of eliminating the opt-out? Okay. Oh, now, listen to what I said. How many would be in favor of eliminating the opt-out, which is the administration's proposal? Okay, how many would be opposed? That's where you raise your hands now, if you're opposed to what they're proposing. Okay.
So let me give you a little bit more background information. The opt-out is, as an employee of the university, you currently can say, I do not want to participate in your health care plan. I have the right to opt out of the health care benefit. That is currently your situation. What the administration and the Joint Health Care Committee are proposing is to take that option away from you. And this affects, right now, there are about 570 opt-outs.
Yeah, and of which 100 are dual employees, so it's
right.
470 that would be affected.
Right. So those people who have, in fact, opted out would be forced back onto the plan. Opting out is where this has affected people, for example, people with military spouses. So they have insurance through their spouse, and they don't want to pay for the university's insurance. So that's the roughly the impact of it. The university's stance on this is saying, you asked to increase the size of the pool, the number of people who are paying the 18%, and just a little bit more background information, the university pays 82% of our total health care bill. And we pay 18. So what the university is saying by taking away the opt-out is that by forcing those 500-plus people back onto the plan, you will increase the number of people who are paying into that 18% of the cost. Well, that is, in fact, true. But when you get down into the numbers, there's some problems with their numbers. I will say that, again, obviously, all of those people that I heard and all of the emails that I have received have been opposed to taking away the opt-out. I've not heard anyone in favor of it. So given the information I've just told you, do you have any more questions about this one motion on taking away the opt-out?
I just have a statement. Are they aware that
TRICARE or UnitedHealthcare April 1st is a secondary insurance. So if Blue Cross Blue Shield people, or if military people take Blue Cross Blue Shield, TRICARE will not only pay second, they will also charge for every military visit in the military hospital, which is normally free.
Yeah.
And I'm in this situation right now where Blue Cross Blue Shield just got billed over $20,000 of back medical because they did not, because TRICARE did not have their paperwork correct, and they just realized that they were the secondary insurance. And Blue Cross Blue Shield has had to pay out that money now.
So on these, it's really, really important that you communicate your specific circumstances or issues or concerns about it to, like, for example, you can send it directly to me, or you can send it directly to Erica Van Fine, or you can send it directly to President Gamble, or you can comment on the blogs. You can also, Abel Tito is the chair of the Joint Healthcare Committee. You can send him your feedback. It's really important that you encourage your colleagues to comment, to make it known, the specific circumstances, because I can guarantee you they haven't thought of them all, but they're out there, and they're affecting a significant number of the employees. Excuse me. So
this is Kirsten Bay in Nome, and I listened into the forum. I think it was with UAF. That was the time I was able to go. And the one thing, you know, I hadn't really thought about who the opt-out thing will affect, and there was the talk about the military spouses, and then also about people that have benefits through the Indian Health Service. And I was just wondering if there's any anecdotal information about people really considering discontinuing their employment with the university over this issue. I mean, it seemed like the comments that I heard from people were sort of to that point. You know, why do I want to continue to work? You know, for the university, if I'm, you know, being forced to take a insurance when I don't need it, and I especially, I was thinking, you know, if there's a, you know, significant, you know, number of people who are, you know, Native Alaskans working for the university who may not, because of this issue, you know, that, you know, certainly would be a negative thing. So I just was wondering if people had made that comment that, like, you know, I may quit if I'm forced into the insurance process.
I can say I heard people say exactly that at the forums. I've also, as a result of last July 1's increases, I know of two people who resigned their positions at the university because they could be on their partner or their spouse's insurance and work part-time somewhere else or such. So I know of people who have left because of the cost of health care. And my understanding of some of what I've heard is that, yeah, well, it makes no sense for me to continue to work here. Chris?
Yeah, this is Chris Bex. I know of two coworkers that have indicated that they will no longer be able to work for UAF because it is going to be too expensive for them to pay for that.
Yeah.
The meeting I was at, one former military, you know, retired military guy said, this amounts to a liability for me now. It's going to be a 6% pay cut. And I think he showed exactly what the problem is with this opt-out plan.
Right.
So
Gary was asking, so with the background information that you have, Gary asked for a vote on how many of you would support.
Okay. First, supporting the eliminating the opt-out, which has not been the prevailing view, and I think we had a predominant amount of people. I mean, anybody want to change their vote? I mean, I think we have a sense of it. With reference to the spousal surcharge, do we want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, the sense
you didn't ask for, like, the people on the phones position.
Right, you didn't ask for a phone.
Say that one more time.
Yeah.
You just asked for a show of hands in the room, but not for people on the phone?
Oh, well, feel free to weigh in. Yeah, sure. All those, I guess, however we want to do that, all those in favor of eliminating the opt-out provision as the administration has recommended, I guess, signified by saying aye. Okay. All those that would oppose eliminating the opt-out provision, please say aye.
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 Thank you.
So the next question is on the spousal surcharge. That's the next of the nine motions that gets the most feedback or reaction. And the spousal surcharge is essentially, they're calling it the working spouse surcharge. So my spouse has a job and has elected to not use that their employer's health care benefit. They want the university's. So the university is going to charge me up to $1,200 a year to have that spouse on my plan.
In addition to the regular premium.
You look at your health care charges, there's employee, employee plus spouse, employee plus dependents and family. So in addition to what they're already charging you because you're adding the spouse, they're going to put another up to $1,200 on top of it. There's been a lot of pushback on that motion as well, feeling we're already paying extra to have the spouse on our health insurance. Why are we? Well, it's only for spouses who are working somewhere else and have opted out of their employer's health insurance to come to ours.
Are they limiting it only to spouses? Because if you have a child up to the age of 26 can remain on Blue Cross Blue Shield without any, they don't have to be limited to their in college, anything. It's the age 26 cutoff
only
line?
Only spouses at this point, yes.
So how is that fair? I mean, has that point been brought up, that people can have these children on too?
They said they couldn't eliminate children.
They said it was illegal.
Illegal to eliminate a 25-year-old that has a full-time job?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep.
Federally mandated dependents.
They also said in the forum that, and I don't know if this is true of dependents above the age of 21, you know, and I'm sure they'll get data on that in a few years, but that dependents are cheaper than spouses.
Yes.
Whether that's true at 25, I have no idea.
So I apologize. In the interest of time, as we are already at the end of our meeting, scheduled meeting time, I'm going to move this discussion along. Do you, as an advisory vote to the staff health care committee representatives, do you support the additional charge for spouses, or otherwise known as the working spousal surcharge? All those that support the spousal surcharge, please raise your hand in the room. All those that support the spousal surcharge online, please say aye.
I have mixed feelings about it, and I guess I don't have a position one way or the other at this point.
All right. Does that help you, Debbie and Gary?
I would guess that the absence of yeses means they oppose it. Yes, thank you.
All right. Okay, so we'll move from 10A. As noted on the agenda, Gary Newman and Debbie Coxon are our representatives to the Staff Healthcare Committee. And then they inform the two representatives from that group to the Joint Healthcare Committee. They also have taken actions, the Staff Healthcare Committee. When they take a motion, it comes to Staff Alliance, and we can then carry it forward from there. Item 10B, very quickly, Staff Alliance Compensation Committee. I have asked this group, and Brad Crick and Mary Alice Short are your representatives on this committee. It is also made up of two representatives from each of the major administrative units. I have asked them to bring several proposals forward for other improvements to compensation for employees at the university. So one of the one that's been approved by this committee already is alternative work schedules, including telecommuting. I'm clarifying the policy on that. So what will happen with these? They will forward them to Staff Alliance. It is my intent as Chair of Staff Alliance to put out a survey to all university employees that lists these suggestions and asks for you to rank them and or you to comment on them. Once we have feedback from UA employees, we'll take these to the President and say we'd like you to consider these changes to our non-dollars compensation. So our work schedule, our sick leave, there are several ideas currently going on. So I'm just making you aware, one of the ideas that we've talked about is having Mary Alice's staff affairs group, because she's also on the committee, having her review her bringing those to you through the Staff Affairs Committee for comments. So I'll keep you in the loop on that. The final one is 11 external UAF committee reports. Those are typically in written report. On occasion, we have a representative that wishes to make a verbal because there's something that they want your input on or they want to vote on or things like that, but typically they're written reports. Gary, I'm going to move first to membership. Do we have someone interested in serving on the Parking Advisory Committee, 11B? Tom Langdon? Anyone else? Oh, Aaron? Okay. I will contact the two of you, and then I'll make the appointment to the committee. It may be that one of you is point and one of you is alternate. And then as a background, I should have told you, in the spring, you'll get a table, and it lists all these committee assignments, and it tells you when those appointments expire. Some of the committees are annual. Some of them are 2 years. Some of them are, one of them, I think, is even a three-year committee. You'll see when those expirations, term expirations are, and those seats then become open for someone else to move into them. But also then we certainly will give a great deal of weight to someone who's served on it before and has the knowledge and experience already. And then, of course, you are welcome to step down at any time if you want to step away from one and move to another. Having said that, the next one is the Technology Advisory Board. We need one representative for that. We have plenty. We
this
have
is
four
Adam.
Interests. You have those. So Nicole will get your names, and I will probably talk to each of you. Is this the one that we might have two? We might have two on this committee. We're asking for clarification from the chair. So it may be that two of you are reps and two of you are alts.
Only been one to my knowledge.
Their bylaws say.
Sorry for.
No.
So we're
sorry
we're
for interrupting,
it.
But
I'm sorry. Is there someone online?
Yes. I'm sorry for interrupting. This is Adam, and I would like to serve on that committee as well as the Rural Affairs, and I think it would be important because of how much technology is needed for the distance education in the rural campuses.
Okay, we'll add your name to this. Generally, the way that it works is I'll talk to each of you and. You know, make an appointment. So make sure that Nicole has your names and the committee that you're interested in. And on these two in particular, the Technology Advisory Board and the Parking Advisory Committee, and then I'll, in the next week or two, contact you and make the decision. And once we do that, I'll try to hook you up with who it is on the committee. What happens is I forward a letter to the chair of that committee informing them of your appointment and asking them about your term and so on. So we'll go from there. On 11A, Gary, do you have something?
Just real quickly, you have enclosed, attached all the different plans and projects they're looking at for this fiscal year. Campus, lower campus is going to be a mess. They're digging up Utilidor in front of Wood Center. Wood Center is getting a whole revitalization. Engineering building addition is going to go on between in that little corner between current Duck Ring building and Bunnell. They're going to be closing Tanana Loop right there, which is going to make another challenge in getting shuttle service and just people getting around. I guess it's going to look like most other campuses do during the summer, just a lot of construction.
Okay, and I'm sorry, I apologize. I'm not sure the numbering. Intercollegiate Athletic Council is also in need of a representative. Debbie Coxon is serving on that now. So if you are interested in the Intercollegiate Athletic Council, being a staff representative on that group, please send your name and statement of interest to Nicole Dufour, our executive secretary or admin. Okay, so unless I'm hearing anything from any of these representatives, I'm going to move us on to item 12, ad hoc committee reports. Brad has a quick and dirty 30-second report on the 2013 calendar.
Yes. Important details. I don't have an estimate for you as to when we'll expect a printed calendar. There was a backlog at printing services, and we didn't get the calendar drafted them until the start of this year. But as soon as I know, we'll get it out. We are going to try and put the digital version of the calendar online, so you'll be able to get it there.
All right, thank you. 12B, the Staff Appreciation Day Committee. Ashley Monroe is the co-chair of that committee with HR this year. This is Staff Appreciation Day for those of you on the main campus, especially is a big event. We need a lot of volunteers on the day of that. If any of you are interested in working on that committee with Ashley at any time, please don't hesitate to let Nicole know. And Ashley is not present today, and apparently the group has not met. But so the next item, 13, is what we call roundtable discussion, and it's a time when we turn off the recording, when you're off the record, and you have the opportunity to express any concerns that you have that weren't on the agenda or that are that involve other aspects of your role as a representative. So typically what we do is, as I said, we turn off the recording. We start in the room. At